is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal this Friday afternoon. Susan McGraw here, and we will hear from Alan Mazurek before our hour wraps up. But it is a pleasure to have an opportunity through a forum like this to talk about shining light and celebrating so many important things happening in our communities, in our world, and in our lives. We have a voice in which to be able to showcase things that oftentimes people don't think about. One of those that tends to kind of fall under the radar sometimes, at least from my perspective, is an education and awareness on what we sort of use the loose term epilepsy for. Now, epilepsy can mean a number of things to a number of people. We've seen it referenced in movies. We think of the concept of seizure as soon as somebody says epilepsy of seizure. And while they're not mutually inclusive, there certainly are connections and so on. So we are not going to diagnose here in this next half an hour or so, but to honor what November is deemed as Epilepsy Awareness Month, we felt it was appropriate to bring in one of the experts from our wonderful Michigan Epilepsy Foundation organization, and just talk a little bit through this disorder. We're actually going to figure out exactly what is appropriate even to call what we know as epilepsy. So Brianna Romines is here, and she is the president of the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan. And I have met Brianna at functions and events, different things over the years. Just full disclosure, my family is very connected to the topic of epilepsy awareness as well as the Epilepsy Foundation. I lost a dear nephew to a SUDEP, which is the sudden unexplained death from epilepsy at the young age of 30. So it's very personal to me, but I'm going to try to keep the personal side out because I'd be crying through the whole thing. So we want to share some awareness and some tips and also just some enlightenment and education so that we all come out a little bit more knowledgeable on the other side of this discussion. So Brianna, it is such a pleasure to have you here today. You're doing amazing work, and we look forward to learning a little bit more about the foundation. Glad to have you.
Susan, wonderful to be here. Thank you so much. And of course, you mentioned November being Epilepsy Awareness Month, and I just want to pause right now and thank you so much for letting us spread awareness. It's really on forums like this that we can get in front of the message, really be very clear and accurate, like you said, on what epilepsy is, what seizures are, and how the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan is here to help.
Well, why don't we start there? One of the things that I think most Metro Detroiters see in the news around, we start to see it in spring, and then by, you know, June, we know that the morning of a Saturday in June at the Detroit Zoo is the big epilepsy walk. And it's a staple in the community and certainly an important one at that. But aside from maybe seeing ads for that or, you know, getting a little insight on some of these special events going on, what is the function, the purpose of the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan?
Sure. So the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy, to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. And so that's our mission statement. But let's kind of start at the top with regards to what is epilepsy. So epilepsy is a neurological condition characterized by reoccurring unprovoked seizures. And of course, the word reoccurring is really important. That means more than one. You know, the human body, everybody kind of gets one seizure in their lifetime based on a variety of factors that can make that happen for somebody. But just having that one seizure doesn't necessarily mean that you have epilepsy. But what epilepsy does mean is those reoccurring, so more than one. And then, of course, unprovoked. And unprovoked means that it wasn't necessarily caused by a high fever or a medication of side effect of some kind, that these are reoccurring and unprovoked seizures. And the illustration I often like to give people with regards to a seizure is, if you could imagine the brain, it's like a thunderstorm that happens in the brain, and it really kind of throws off that normal brain activity. And of course, where that thunderstorm is taking taking place in the brain and how much of the brain is affected, well, that's what gives you the type of seizure that a particular person will have. And Susan, you nailed it. Like when you think of epilepsy, you oftentimes think of seizures. And when you think of seizures, I think most people think of what we refer to as a tonic-clonic or a grand mal, which is that convulsive seizure where usually pretty memorable. People don't forget seeing one of those. They're oftentimes kind of violent. The person stiffens, jerks, and sometimes falls to the ground. And yes, that is one type of seizure, but there are over 30 different types of seizures. And sometimes they can simply be as subtle as a staring spell. And so as you can imagine, with a neurological condition that has nuance to it like that, it oftentimes can go misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed. We see a lot of school age children that are often treated for either ADHD or just a lack of attention. But what's actually happening, those staring spells that they're experiencing, are in fact seizures. And of course, that's why a big part of our organization is, as you mentioned, spreading the word, spreading awareness, making people more cognizant so that they can recognize when a seizure is taking place and then get someone to appropriate care as quickly as possible. Like I said, obviously with a grand mal or tonic clonic seizure, that's pretty obvious to recognize. Those typically do come with, visits to the hospital or doctor, but it's those more subtle ones, that sometimes, can go under the radar, for a while. And we don't want to see that happen.
Thank you. That's great insight. Brianna, when we work on the knowledge that someone is diagnosed as epileptic, that they have epilepsy, is epilepsy then categorized as a disease, a disorder? You said the word condition, I heard in there. So what do we call it? And do we call it different things based on different levels of severity or intensity? And I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but when you have cancer, you have the disease of cancer.
Sure.
When you have epilepsy, does that kind of mean that there are symptoms that happen unique to you that this term can envelop? That's
sure.
Kind of how I interpret it. But I'd be curious from sort of the official perspective, how you would identify that.
You've touched on something that I will tell you has brought much debate, whether or not to call it a disorder or a disease or, a condition. But I think the important thing to keep in mind here is that while we speak to epilepsy as a whole, if you look within the condition, it is a range of epilepsies. In fact, you'll hear a lot of the language actually shifting to the epilepsies, because there's a variety of different rare epilepsy syndromes out there. You've got Lennox-Gastaut, you've got Dravet. There's a whole host of rare epilepsy syndromes. And so oftentimes what you're starting to hear is that the epilepsies, they really encompass this spectrum. I mean, that's the unique situation and also communicating with the people that we serve, because we've got some folks in the epilepsy community that their seizures are well controlled. It has very little impact on their daily life. And then we've got the other side of the spectrum, which their seizures are not able to be controlled and are affecting daily life. And so, and again, an organization like ours, we're really doing our best to meet people where they're at in their epilepsy journey and really have something for everyone. And we know that this is an ongoing issue. One in 26 people will be diagnosed with epilepsy in their lifetime. Think about that. One in 26. It's a big number. And if you even take a broader perspective, one in 10 people will have a seizure. And so you'll see a lot of the initiatives, Susan, that we have at the Epilepsy Foundation are surrounding that seizure recognition and first aid. We frankly wanted it to be as common, as synonymous as, you know, understanding CPR, because the likelihood that each one of us will witness a seizure and need to administer seizure first aid is really high. And so that's why a lot of our efforts surround around that.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. In the process, and again, while we're not going to get heavily into anything medically related, as I'm not a doctor, I know you're not as well,
nope.
but you have resources available and training options available and so on. So let's sort of dig a little deeper into what the foundation does offer. I understand that, and I know firsthand, support. It tends to be one of the very biggest components. And I'll tell you, talk about a community, you know, a welcoming and a just a loving community of people, like-minded people going through similar yet potentially different scenarios at any different point in their journey. So talk a little bit about starting with that one, please. And then we'll get into options if someone is in, you know, in education or in an area where you're dealing with a number of people, groups of people, and you want to get some of this kind of training to identify and then know how to deal with or treat a seizure, for example.
Yeah. So Susan, I think you touched on, and I know I'm biased, but I believe the epilepsy community is the best community. I mean, there is so much about having epilepsy that can, and this is what we're told, and this is what I've witnessed, that can feel so isolating. For that minute when you're sitting in the doctor's office, and either as a parent or as an individual, and you hear the word epilepsy, there's something for that second that makes you feel like you're the only one, you know, that and that is a huge part about why the organization is here. We are very fortunate in Michigan to have some fantastic medical partners. We have comprehensive epilepsy centers in this state. And I'll tell you, there are some states that don't have any, and we have many, many. So we're so grateful for that. But in addition to that medical side, like you said, is the everything else. And the support is a big piece of that. So we just love to wrap our arms around our epilepsy community and just remind them that they are not alone, that we, the foundation, are here for them, and that the epilepsy community itself is there for each other. And I know you mentioned one of our biggest events of the year is our Stroll for Epilepsy that takes place at the zoo in June, and date for 2023 is coming soon, so stay tuned. But one of the best things about that day is watching the true camaraderie play out amongst the thousands of people that are there. It is such a tight-knit community. And frankly, we need each other. And that is where we are here. We run a variety of different groups. We call them our Call and Connect groups. They take place either over the phone or via Zoom. They're kind of a virtual support group, if you will, but we just, because we cover the entire state, our organization serves the entire state, including the UP. We've got groups for parents of children with epilepsy, adults with epilepsy, teens with epilepsy, seniors with epilepsy. So we really just, we want to meet, again, people where they're at in their journey, remind them they are not alone, and just collectively wrap our arms around this community and say, we are here. We understand. We hear you. Your voice is valid. And we can get through this together.
Fantastic. In the process of learning more about specific resources, very similar to ones you just discussed, I want to make sure that we, not just now, but again, as we wrap up, but showcase an opportunity to directly reach your organization. So I'm thinking epilepsymichigan.org is the website to give. Yes.
Yeah. So the two best access points to us are, like you said, our website, which is epilepsymichigan.org. It is fully disability accessible. It actually just went through an overhaul. So please visit us on there. But the other thing I'd love to mention is we have what we call our Here For You helpline. And it is 1-800-377-6226. Give us a call. You will talk to a real person. We will get you to the right hands, and we're here for you.
Thank you. Excellent. In terms of opportunities for training, for resources, you gave some great statistics, or great as in intense and important We don't like the statistics, of course. We don't want to have, you know, the goal is to not have to have statistics at all and say zero seizures, zero
absolutely
people with epilepsy, of course. But when we're talking about 1 in 10 having a seizure and 1 in 26 people diagnosed with epilepsy, that is not something you can look away from and say that'll never impact me or anybody I know. Chances are everybody comes in contact with or knows 26 people. And so you figure one of them at least potentially could be going through something like this or could at some point. So yep. Statistically speaking, the odds are not great that we're going to be able to avoid any, you know, connection with epilepsy. So what should we know? What should we do? What should we be prepared for? Should we find ourselves either having someone say, look, this is, I'm diagnosed with this, so I want you to be prepared should I have an issue? Or if we are just in a big place with a bunch of people and somebody starts to seize.
So you touched on really great points. It is very statistically speaking likely that we will encounter a seizure. In Michigan, we have almost 109,000 people living with active epilepsy, and about 14,000 of them are children. So again, really pertinent information. So we have dedicated our time and talent and resources to developing seizure first aid trainings. And so you can access those a couple different ways. Of course, all of it's on our website, which we've talked about. And we have trainings that are live and instructor led. So our team, and especially in this month of November, are holding live trainings that you can very easily register. Of course, all of this is free, and get a seizure first aid certification. So go through the training and get certified, and you know seizure first aid. There's also web-based training. So maybe that time that we're offering the instructor led training doesn't work well for you. Well, you can take it a non-instructor led, which is web-based. And again, take it at your leisure. We have a full seizure first aid certification that runs about 60 to 75 minutes, or a quickie training. It's about 30 minutes or less that you can, again, know the basics of seizure recognition and first aid. All of that is free. All of that is available right now. And the other population that we're really heavily focused on, because of the statistics I've shared, are our schools. You know, think about it. We talked about 1 in 26 people will get diagnosed with epilepsy. You know, think about the average school classroom. It's about, I'd say, around 26 to 30 kids. And so again, and it's a long period of time that our kids are at school. It's very likely. In fact, what we see oftentimes is a lot of first time seizures happen at the schools. And so we really want our school personnel to be well equipped to recognize those seizures, or if they know they have a student with epilepsy, that they can provide that enriching and thriving school environment for them. So we actually have a training, again, available on demand right now, specifically designed for our school personnel. And that's available right now. In addition to that, we are working with our legislative partners on House Bill 4970, because we'd love it to be where that's a school standard, right? Right now it's optional, and that's great. And we've got so many school personnel members willing to take the training, which is fantastic. But we'd really like to make that be the standard. And there's 19 other states that have made it their standard, and we want Michigan to be right up there with it. House Bill 4970 would just make that be the case, where all school personnel would be trained every 2 years on seizure recognition and first aid, as well as there are occasions where some kids with epilepsy do need rescue medications. And so it also make that training available for at least one individual in each school as well. So again, just trying to wrap our arms around our young people with epilepsy, creating that safe environment. And one of the things that we think will happen out of that is when our school personnel know how to recognize a seizure, we suspect that the time that maybe a child starts to have those seizures, especially those ones that are a little more subtle, that time frame between first seizure and diagnosis will shorten, because we know the quicker that we can get to treatment, the higher likelihood of seizure freedom.
We are joined today by Brianna Romines, who is the president of the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan here on the WHFR Journal. And we are honoring the Epilepsy Foundation, as well as those that are dealing with and living with epilepsy, as well as those who have gone before us based on or because of symptoms of epilepsy this November, as we are again sort of shining a light on the epilepsy topic for Epilepsy Awareness Month here in November. I have a lot of purple clothes because purple is the color, right?
Yes, it is.
Of the epilepsy color. I have a purple pen right in front of me here. But that concept of strength in numbers, Brianna, just in sharing with my family this, the foundation and knowledge that others are going through, have gone through, could go through something similar to what any individual is yeah. facing at any point, like you said, meeting people where they are in their journey. Unfortunately, our journey took a turn that was unfortunate and quite catastrophic in my family with the loss of my nephew Dominic. But I'll tell you, the sort of the feeling that you can still make a difference, the feeling that you can still be a part of something sort of bigger than you and take something so tragic and turn it into something empowering where you feel like you're helping others is a wonderful way to continue on that healing journey. How many people that are involved in your organization, just roughly, would you say are sort of in that situation that are connected with and still trying to do everything possible so others don't have to take, you know, have a similar situation in their lives?
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking about this. And I know it's a hard thing to talk about. And I'll tell you that I don't think the average person thinks of epilepsy as something that you can die from. And we know that to be the case. Statistically speaking, one in every 1,000 people with epilepsy will succumb to SUDEP, which you did mention is sudden, unexplained death in epilepsy. There's also other individuals that we have unfortunately lost due to what we'll call epilepsy related causes, which is seizure, wrong place, wrong time. We have an individual who, lost their daughter to a seizure that happened in a body of water, and they weren't able to get pulled to safety quick enough. Now, I want to be careful. This does not mean that everybody with epilepsy isn't able to swim. But in their case, that was a very tragic consequence of seizure, wrong place, wrong time. So we have done a lot in terms of education and awareness with regards to SUDEP. Together really with our medical partners, because as you can imagine, it's also a really hard conversation to have in the exam room. Imagine getting the note, you know, the information that now I have epilepsy and then needing to have this discussion. So, but of course, we believe it's that information carries power. And so we have to arm our epilepsy community with all of the information we possibly can. And that does include SUDEP. And so one of the things we do offer for the families like yours that has had SUDEP touch their lives, unfortunately, is the foundation does offer free grief counseling. So, and also a support group for those families whose lives are touched by SUDEP. If you do, you know, and I hope everybody listening does join us at one of our Stroll for Epilepsies, you'll see that we do have information there. And every year at every Stroll, we have a moment of silence to remember and honor those that have lost their lives to epilepsy, and always keep them at the center of everything that we do.
Thank you. We're all hoping there's going to be a cure. We're all working towards that cure. Until that happens, there are, it seems like on a monthly basis, really helpful and really significant breakthroughs, ideas, options, support systems, things related to technology that can help if someone is potentially, you know, starting to go into, seizure mode. We have epilepsy dogs that are trained exclusively for purposes of being with someone who has the predisposition to seizures and so on. So while the cure may not be imminent, although we hope it is, it doesn't mean that there aren't steps along the way that are making progress. So any of that that you'd like to reference, or a little bit of a motivational talk on the progress that is being made ongoing?
No, I appreciate you championing that message, because you're absolutely right. And again, if we think of the epilepsies as some of these unique syndromes and not one bit, it is very possible in our lifetime for some of those epilepsy syndromes, we may see a cure to a particular seizure or a particular seizure type or syndrome. And we have to stay hopeful in that area. And yes, in the meantime, we, you know, I think back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and there was maybe a couple treatments on the market for epilepsy. Fast forward to where we are now, so many cutting edge treatment options being brought to market in the area of pharmaceuticals, in the area of devices. You know, if you think of the brain as this kind of electrical system and approach treatments that way, we're seeing a lot of promising treatments in that area. And then, of course, brain surgery. You know, I think we hear brain surgery and maybe all of us kind of, you know, clam up a little bit. But there are some that are becoming very, very non-invasive and have really, really measurable results. For people living with epilepsy, we know that with all the current treatment options out there, still about 30% don't have seizure control. And that is why we fight so hard. And that's why new treatments are being introduced to the marketplace. We want to see that gap minimize even more. But we are so grateful for how far that we've come in terms of recognizing epilepsy, finding its nuance. You know, the area of genetics in epilepsy is really emerging, and we're able to find different genetic mutations that will lend itself to epilepsy, or understanding if there's a hereditary component. We oftentimes see epilepsy that have occurred in multi-generations or more than one child in one family. And so we're starting to get insight into all that. With all of that said, most people's epilepsy, there is no known cause. There's unknown origin. And I just want to acknowledge that can be really frustrating. And in addition to grappling with the diagnosis, you kind of want to know why, you know, why me? Why now? Why my child? And oftentimes we're not able to give that answer. But again, you're not alone. If you're listening and this has happened to you or someone that you love, just know that you are not alone. There is a whole community here. When you're ready, we're ready to be here for you and answer your questions and be that listening ear.
Brianna, thank you for that information and insight. In our personal family situation, it wasn't until my nephew was into college age that he started having his seizures and was diagnosed and so on. But the opportunity to get support early and quickly, even if it's before an official diagnosis, but you're thinking something could be the case and so on. The foundation, again, the concept of overcoming challenges of living with epilepsy, identifying the fact that it is epilepsy is probably the first thing, but, you know, so that we can do the life-saving, you know, approach and finding the cures and stopping seizures and so on. So how many people would you say sort of come to you and say, I think this might be something that our family is dealing with? Do you have some resources to help us figure out how to get diagnosed? Because as we know, it could be at childhood, it could be in the middle of a perfectly healthy, wonderfully active life, mm-hmm. It could be at an older age. There's just no rhyme or reason.
No, and thank you so much for touching on that, Susan, because I'll tell you, at one point, epilepsy, and again, this was a while ago, but it was kind of in that bucket of, you know, childhood conditions, right? But what we know is that epilepsy can happen to anyone at any time, period. And so, you know, that first time seizure can happen literally at any age, at any moment. Now, we do see a slight uptick in prevalence in childhood and in seniors. So, you know, that we see that in prevalence, but by no means does it mean if you aren't in those two categories that epilepsy couldn't happen to you. And yes, so through our helpline, it's not unusual at all for someone to reach out and say, you know, I think I'm having seizures. And so we are always just so grateful to get in touch with somebody as early on as in their journey as possible. One of the resources that we have are things to bring up with your doctor, questions to ask, how to prepare for a doctor's appointment so you can really maximize that opportunity. Seizure diaries, you know, most doctors, they so appreciate you being able to categorize or show over time. Okay. These are when the seizures happened. This is how long they were. Video footage of what one looked like. These are all those helpful hints, that as soon as we can, you know, share those with you, we want to. Of course, a lot of that information, of course, lives on our website, but also lives with the people that work here. We've got a lot of individuals from the epilepsy community that are part of this organization and that can shed their, you know, light and insight and guidance. But we actually not too long ago just had kind of our gala style event. It's called the Toasting Hope, and it was a wonderful evening. And I had the pleasure of connecting with an individual who the week prior said, I think I'm having these moments of my day that are just going away. And, you know, did a bit of Googling and thought, I think these are seizures. And so grateful that when she typed in seizures in Michigan, boom, we popped up. She showed up to our gala. And by the next day, after we connected with her, by the next day, we were connecting her with the comprehensive epilepsy centers in the state, getting her tied into the right care and the right resources. So thank you for asking that important question, Susan. And we as soon as we can be a part of someone's journey, we believe that we can add value to that.
Well, this month of November gives us a springboard and an opportunity to talk about it a little bit more. But this is something we should be talking about year round, certainly, for the sake of that knowledge is power and awareness and support. Certainly all those things that the mission of the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan stands for. Brianna Romines, we are so grateful for your time today. I'm going to give the telephone number and email address one more time. EpilepsyMichigan.org. EpilepsyMichigan.org. It's just as simple as that. And then that hotline that you mentioned of 800-377-6226. So if you have any thoughts right now that maybe you can benefit from this information, something related to what we've talked about or at least opened up for discussion, please use those as resources. In addition, whether you do or do not know someone with epilepsy or have it yourself, I'm sure, as you mentioned, about opportunities to come together for support and fundraising as well. That information is on your website too. I'm sure you're very, would be open to receiving different types of donations.
Absolutely. So we do rely on the public support to keep our organization running. And so absolutely, to the degree that someone is compelled and able to support our mission, we are so grateful for that. We have some really fun mechanisms. I mentioned the gala style events, Toasting Hope. We have our awesome walks that take place across the entire state of Michigan, as well as some other really unique opportunities. So yeah, if you go to our website, epilepsymichigan.org, there's a donate button. It has all the different unique ways to give. And we, of course, would welcome that so we can be here to do the good work that we're doing.
Thank you. We are hoping also that if you have a purple shirt or purple pants or purple shoes or anything purple this month, please wear it proudly and know that somebody might come up to you and say, oh, you support epilepsy, you know, a cure for epilepsy and hope with epilepsy. And so just embrace that, just own it. So as much purple as we can get out there this month, we totally want to do that. I've got a lot of it, as you might understand. I'm sure you do too. We thank you so much. We thank your team, and we thank the Epilepsy Foundation for everything you're doing, and most importantly, for being a resource to meet and support those that are dealing with and suffering with this. We know there is a positive, forward movement, and we love that we can be a part of it through organizations such as yours. So keep up the great work. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an honor and mission to do this work. Thank you, Susan, so much for this opportunity today.
Appreciate it. My pleasure. We have more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Stay with us. Be right back.
Please. Please join WHFR on Friday from 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. as DJ Kitty Love brings 2 hours of the best in new blues releases and artists from the local Metro Detroit area to the 89.3 FM airwaves. Listen to all hues of blues during the Highway 61 cruise at Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.FM.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek with you till 2 o'clock this afternoon. Thanks to Susan McGraw and the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan for the first segment of our program today. In addition to Epilepsy Awareness Month, today, of course, we also commemorate Veterans Day, and we're going to do so on our program today with an episode from a series called With Good Reason, and it's called Messages from a Forgotten Troop Ship. In the 1960s, it took almost 3 weeks to cross the sea from America to Vietnam, 3 weeks for young men in crowded cabins with saltwater showers, and absolutely nothing to do but think about home, about the war, and about what's next. For some, it was a round-trip journey. For others, of course, they never did make it back home. This documentary shares three stories from and about soldiers who traveled on the troop ship the General Nelson M. Walker. Through found tape and contemporary interviews, it recreates the troop ship and captures the moments outside of combat on the ship heading towards Vietnam. Messages from a Forgotten Troop Ship here on the WHFR Journal.
On January 18th, the U.S. Navy ship General Nelson Walker dropped anchor 3 miles off the coast of Vietnam near the town of Bung Tau. On board were elements of the 25th...
I'm Jim Hardy, H-A-R-D-Y. I was one of the few troops that went over on a troop ship. The name was General Nelson M. Walker.
Back in 67, well, we took a little trip along with J.G. Johnson on his mighty battleship. We took 3,000 troopers and a bunch of yellow tack, and despite all his efforts, we'll make it there and back.
When we got in there, the ship was a mess. We had to stow all of our gear, all of our rifles. They were chained to our bunks, and the life jackets, we all had a life jacket. The bunks were canvas, probably 2.5 foot wide, a little over 5 feet long, and they were folded up when you didn't use them, and we used the bottom bunk for seats when we were sitting around writing letters, playing cards, or talking down in the quarters. Then when they folded down, they were about 4 high, probably no more than 6 inches above your nose. There would be a lot of graffiti. If you're reading this and you're on your way over, well, I'm on my way back, send your girlfriend's phone number. The GIs had a lot of humor that kept you sane.
Well, we flashed our dollars and the girls came a-running. There was as many there as there was a while ago. We drank a lot of liquor and it began to blow. Until our time ran out and we had to go aboard.
Mom, Dad, and boys. Well, today was Easter Sunday. We had a big storm. We get up at 5:30 and clean the quarters from 8 to 10, then the rest of the time is ours. Well, it's late and I got to go. I'll write more tomorrow. Monday. Not much has happened today. The water is calmer, though. We got a ship's paper today, and I learned that Dayton beat North Carolina. I won $5 off a sucker. Asked Joe if he remembers when he read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Well, I got to see an albatross. That's the bird in the story. You know, if this boat wasn't going where it is, this would be a neat trip. That's about it for today. Write more later. Good night.
Beautiful.
Even though we was going to Vietnam, and I knew where we were going, when we got out in the middle of that 64 million square miles of water, it's utterly beautiful. You could look down. It looked like a couple hundred feet and see the fish. We had flying fish that would fly along with the boat, go in and out of the water. There would be sharks in the back of the ship when they dumped the garbage, you know, after dinner. And when the water was calm, the water is the same color as the sky, and you could see a fine hairline all the way around you, and you could almost imagine yourself even upside down, because there was no difference between the sky and the water. Tuesday. Well, nothing happened today, and I mean nothing. There is nothing to see but water. The Navy's food tastes like S blank blank blank, so I'll be glad to eat the Army's cooking again, let alone Mom's. Well, that's it for now. I'll write more tomorrow. Ready for Wednesday? I forgot to mention that while we were near Hawaii, we picked up their radio station. Some have Hawaiian music, and they have a couple hillbilly stations, too. We got a big kick out of them. That's about it for the day, so good night. Sunday. Well, this is my second Sunday on the ship. They don't have a Catholic priest here, but they have a type of service for the Catholics by a chaplain. They sell us tan lotion on the boat, too. I am starting to look like I've been in Florida for a few weeks. We traveled 3,288 miles so far and 2,871 to go. Well, that's about it for the day, so good night. Early in the morning, few of us went out on deck, and the waves were probably 30, 40 feet. And when I looked out, it was like watching a black and white movie. Water was gray, the sky was gray, the ship was gray. There was no color. And shortly after that, they give all hands the quarters. So we went in and they locked the doors. You could hear them locking the doors and screwing them down. So they buttoned us up. Then the storm just kept getting worse and worse. The waves would go up 90 feet and take the ship up 90 feet. Then the water would drop down and the ship would free fall in the air and slam on the water. And when it hit, it would vibrate the whole ship like a big gong, like a sledgehammer hit the side. It would go boom, boom. And we thought the ship was coming apart and we were locked in it. One of the sergeants or something said, I think we're supposed to be on the edge of a typhoon. And I said, well, I damn sure don't want to be in the middle of it then. Let your children play. My dad was a merchant marine. And he told me when you get in a bad storm, he said, get busy or take a nap. Well, we didn't have nothing to do, so I laid in my bunk and I fell asleep. And he was right on that. So when I got up, ship still tossing, but there was nobody in the room. You're talking 250 guys were missing. So I go up to the restroom, and the urinals are like 30 feet long in like a V going towards the bow, the front of the ship. There were guys in there just all sick, and the puke was sloshing back and forth and all over. And of the 3,400 guys on the ship, more than 2,000 of them were throwing up. Even though we were going to Vietnam, there were guys praying, please let us get to Vietnam. We got in late at night. I do remember somebody coming down, busting into our room and saying, we're there. So we all go running up on the deck, and Vung Tau is 11 degrees above the equator. So it is like at night, about 90 degrees out, very balmy because we're on the ocean, hardly no wind, almost like a light fog. And we could see the mountains in the distance being lit up by heat lightning. And then we hear the rumble of the thunder. And then it dawned on me, that isn't heat lightning and that isn't thunder. And then you looked at the guys on your ship and you wonder, on the way back, how many of them is going to make the return voyage?
Below the DMZ in South Vietnam, 1967. The year began as it would end, with fierce fighting. In February, right after the ceasefire for the Vietnamese New Year, the whole character of fighting changed. From the Mekong Delta in the south, north along the coast, to the bases of Chu Lai and Da Nang, from Quang Nai in southeastern I Corps, to Wei and Quang Tri in the north, along the DMZ from the China Sea to the borders of Laos and Cambodia, Marines saw plenty of action.
I was a casual dresser, you know, jeans, shirt, sweater, earrings. We used to have window pane earrings. I don't know if anybody remembers those. They were really nice. They were long and they had like little windows of color. My hair was longer, mid back. I just washed it and let it go. Of course, I thought I looked great. My mother would say, "You're going out like that?" I said, "Yeah." What do you mean? Anyway, my name now is Arlen Marie Salu, and when Augie and I were dating, it was Arlene Siborowski. He was about 5'5", and he always tried to get shoes that had a heel on them, you know? He had dark, curly kind of hair. It was actually a medium brown. Sometimes it was darker in the winter and lighter in the summer. As soon as he shaved, he had a beard. He had beautiful hands. His hands were just exquisitely drawn. You know, the way the bones and the fingertips and the thumbs were. He had Italian eyebrows. We used to tease him and his sister that his eyebrows were going to grow together. Oh, dear. I thought he was gorgeous, but, you know, I thought he was something else. Anyway, I'm biased. We moved to San Francisco because we were just all sick of everything. You have to remember, this is 1967. I was sick of school when Augie was drafted, and we had discovered marijuana. You know, we saw Janis Joplin practicing in the park, and where we lived, the Jefferson Airplane practiced across the street at this Chinese church. It was a groove, you know.
It was officially announced today that there are now more than 300,000 American servicemen in Vietnam. But many of them were too busy fighting today to take notice.
He wrote to me and told me that he was coming to Oakland, and they were boarding the ship there, and they were going to go to Vietnam. I was 20 years old, and I guess you think you can do anything when you're 20. I decided I was going to go to Oakland and try to see him. I just thought if I didn't try, I would not forgive myself, because he was there. He was there. So I started at the docks, and all I said was, "I really need to see Private August Battaglia." And I started with privates and sergeants and then lieutenants, and then by the time I got to people that had all that stuff on their chest, I was in tears because I thought, what in the heck am I doing? I was really scared, but all I kept saying was, "I need to see Private August Battaglia." And I just kept saying that. You can see, imagine how scared I was. Anyway, somewhere along there, they pulled him off. And they let us have a room. And he says the usual wonderful things a man tells a woman. You know, "I love you. I'm crazy about you. You're crazy. Please don't give yourself another permanent." You know, that. Kiss my sister for me. And and I'll be back before you know it. And I was really glad I did it.
Testing one, test. I got you two letters today. And I was just about to make you a tape so now I can say the important things. First unimportant thing. I got the package. I love you. And I got the money. And I love you. And they're not going to let me go to Hawaii. I couldn't get it. But next month I'm going to go to Hong Kong. Of all places. And I am going to rest. And I'm going to pick me up a nice, cute $20 12-string guitar and do some grooving or something. I'm going to sing a little bit. I'm going to have to stop the tape for a minute while I grab this Vietnamese guitar here. I'll be right back.
It's known that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stash behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by a forgotten word.
Well, you know what happened? That letter came, I think it came in February of 68. It took a particular kind of tape recorder. I think they were called reel-to-reel. And we didn't have that kind of equipment. When I met my husband, now that I'm with, I told him I had this tape from Augie that I never listened to. And he told me, he says, I think my mother has that kind of a tape recorder.
Or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking.
And so I didn't listen to it till 1987. Yeah.
That you've been in the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you just gentle on my mind.
Isn't it funny all the things I want to say? I love you. I just do. I'm fine. I'm still in one piece. I still have all my arms and legs and hands. And I still have my voice. And I thank something, honey. I don't know if I thank God. I don't know if he'd hear me, if he's there. But I just thank something. I'm gonna be all right. I think I'll sing.
I will break out from the prison that has held me for so long. I will fly as one just promised all the riches of a song. I will stay on one.
Jeez, when was it? I think it was January of 68. My friend and I bought a car, a 62 Valiant, and we just went up and down Highway 1, and we just lived in the 62 Valiant. My friend, she had grandparents who lived in Riverside, and so when we took off, my mail was sent to her grandparents in Riverside. They lived in a trailer, and I walked up to the trailer after we had opened the gate and she was driving the car in. And I said, hey, I said, did I get any mail from Augie? And her grandfather was very old. And he said, Augie, isn't that the boy who was killed in Vietnam? And that's how I found out my mother had sent a telegram there. Anyway, that's how that happened.
No, I love you. No, I care. I'll see you soon. Really. It's getting shorter and shorter. Yet it's a lifetime. But I am coming home to you. better believe it, woman. I told you I'd never leave you alone. I told you I'd never leave you alone.
I'm 66. Augie died just before I turned 21. And, you know, he's part and parcel of my life. He's helped make me who I am. And it's just so wonderful to hear his voice. And I loved his last words, "I am never going to leave you alone," which has turned out to be true.
Because of the following CBS News special report, the program normally seen at this time will not be presented today.
We can't reach those big guns, and they just keep dropping in. There's nothing you can do. It's like being a big bullseye on top of a hill, and you're just sitting there waiting. You can't be safe. You can be lucky. That's it.
You can't be safe. You can be lucky.
That's it.
Stuff landing all over, bouncing off you, and you get just as scared every time, and it gets worse. The closer they get, the more they throw. The more you get scared. When you get up, it's a wonderful feeling just to be alive, to be able to walk.
If I live 100 years, I'll just never, ever be able to tell the story when we were all boxed in. They were all around, and they were all over our perimeter, and we're throwing grenades, and I got pretty close, and just run up to one of these kids and say, "Marine, we're going to get out of here, aren't we?" And the kid look up to you and say, "You're damn right we are, Skipper."
3,700 Marines back from Vietnam returned to San Diego today. About 500 represented part of the troop reduction.
It was a three-week voyage coming back from that hellhole, you know. And when we were leaving, I never felt that I was going to get home until I actually arrived here. The Marine Corps believes in doing things before daylight. So 3 o'clock in the morning, we're out there laying on the dock watching these ships, you know, and every time a ship would come in, we would wonder if that was ours. Then it came on the loudspeaker, said that they were out in the ocean waiting for us, and we would all be taken by mic boats. Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I watch them roll away again. Lord, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
I left my
wasting time, you know, and, that's what we were doing. Sitting there wasting time, waiting for the ship to come in. And then you watch them roll away again because it wasn't yours.
It look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay. Watching the
I'm Harmon Adams, Jr. I was born and raised in Buffalo. I went to Vietnam and served in the 1st Marine Air Wing, MAG 16, MAG 21, during the 65, 67 years. I didn't see myself being a steel worker for the rest of my life. And I figured that the Marine Corps would be a step in the right direction.
Shower sure are fun, but don't dare break the rule and turn the water on. The engineer is...
It was very integrated on the ship, you know. You couldn't help when you were all thrown in that little hole together, so we used to talk about things we expected to do, you know, when we got home, and all kinds of stuff that you might expect someone to do after being over there and being on their way home. You know, we would all talk about girlfriends and family and stuff like that. Mostly girlfriends, I guess.
Yippee-yi-yay, yippee-yi-yo, the Nellie Walker plugs along.
we had big plans, plans of reuniting with our families and friends and everything, and being recognized as, you know, hey, saviors of democracy, you know. That's the way we looked at ourselves, but it seems like democracy had passed us by. We were ridiculed, and when we hit San Diego, because that's where we docked at, and we got there and we seen all these protesters with their signs, the hippies and everything, you know, it's like, you know, we're fighting here just so you can do exactly what you're doing, you know. As Billy Joe said later on, we didn't start the fire, you know what I mean? It was devastating to know, and, you know, it's like expecting a birthday party, you know. Find out it's not even your birthday. I felt like I had changed. I was more cognizant of things that were going on. There was a lot to decipher. And I felt like, you know, I'd become more of a skeptic, I guess you would say, about a lot of things. I started questioning everything, especially the political area. When I came back here, I realized that it was this whole country it was in turmoil. It was like you didn't know what to believe and what not to believe. And if you didn't question it, you were just doing a disservice to yourself. So I started questioning everything.
Wrapping up today's edition of the WHFR Journal with messages from a forgotten troop ship from the program With Good Reason as we commemorate Veterans Day this Friday afternoon here on the WHFR Journal. Kitty Love is up next, a trip down Highway 61, some blues for your Friday afternoon coming up in just a moment. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported public radio at 89.3, online at WHFR.FM, making waves.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.